Hi, I'm Archie McFarlane. I'm a research analyst at Tech Against Terrorism, an organization that disrupts terrorist activity online. Welcome back to our podcast. This week, we're investigating a new kind of far-right extremist group, active clubs. They turn the lives of their members around with exercising and community building, all the while pushing them towards a neo-Nazi ideology. When you think of a far-right extremist group, you might imagine people marching in the street, parading Nazi and Confederate flags, spewing hate against all kinds of marginalized people. You might think of the racist violence of the Ku Klux Klan, or even of the Proud Boys during the January 6th Capitol riots. But there's a new group in town that's doing things slightly differently.
They also go beyond the sort of hate and nihilism that is so often associated with the far right, and they talk a lot about fitness and exercise, and they organize hikes and community events for their members. They pick up litter in their communities, and I think it gives them a much more hopeful and positive appeal to a lot of people who are maybe new to the movement and don't know exactly what they're about yet.
That's Brodie MacDonald, a researcher from King's College London and the University of Oxford. He says he's never seen a far-right movement grow so fast. So far, Brodie has identified about 65 active clubs spread throughout the US, Canada, and Europe. They have chapters here in the UK, France, Germany, Scandinavia, Australia, almost all states in the US. The list goes on. And they've only been around for a few years.
And arguably, you know, they've developed a new model for far-right extremism that has sometimes been described as, you know, far-right extremism 3.0, but it's a model that really focuses on proactive engagement, health, fitness, and personal agency. And I think that that is what makes these groups, you know, particularly dangerous and particularly worrying.
So let's delve into active clubs.
Their ideology is very broad and very loose, but it falls squarely within the neo-Nazi white supremacist movement. And so while they have a grounding principle, individual cells or chapters may differ on different interpretations or aspects of the ideology. And their founder, Rob Arundo, actually speaks extensively about this in many of the training materials that have been put out by the group. The focus is not on perfect ideological cohesion, but rather to look at the bigger movement and move past these sort of smaller doctrinal differences that has often, you know, splintered extremist groups into 100 different factions. So they're really focused on avoiding the kind of internal squabbles that have characterized far-right and Salafi jihadist movements for decades.
So is there an element of leaderless resistance to this movement?
Absolutely. They completely adopt the leaderless resistance model that Louis Beam developed in the 1980s, and they have a very decentralized horizontal organizational structure. And while these groups have connections with each other, they are entirely separate entities and led by a local leader or a local leadership group, which allows them to avoid law enforcement or any other kind of crackdown that would take out a central node in the organization. And when we think about countering groups like this, it's very difficult to do so, because even if you are able to, you know, pursue prosecutions against one chapter of the organization, that's as far as it will go. It's very difficult to actually take down the organization in a coherent, hierarchical way, because that's just not how they're organized.
And what's the significance of the founder of the organization that you mentioned?
So the organization was established by Robert Arundo and a few other far-right extremists from Southern California. Robert Arundo himself was originally born in Queens, New York, but he came out and became very active in the far-right scene in Southern California. He's really emblematic of the movement as well, even though he's now imprisoned. He maintains a healthy lifestyle, which is one of the very important things that they talk about ad nauseum within the movement. And I think that he still casts a large shadow over the organization today. Whether you look at their online presence or you look at their rallies, you see, you know, frequent references to Rundo, and you see them republicize some of the propaganda and some of the training that he provided early on to the movement in terms of how to set up active clubs, how to avoid prosecution, how to avoid law enforcement. His ideological and operational influence still looms very large over the organization, even though it has now taken on a life of its own and is, you know, led by different leaders right across the spectrum.
Robert Rundo is a prominent figure in the white supremacist movement in the US. He is the founder of another far-right group called the Rise Above Movement, or RAM. It called itself the premier MMA club of the alt-right. It's now defunct. Rundo's got a history of violence. He's been to prison for assaulting a Latino man with a knife in 2009. He's attacked a journalist, protesters, and a police officer at different pro-Trump rallies. But things changed after the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville in 2017. That's the rally where a bunch of white nationalist and far-right groups came together to protest the removal of a Confederate statue. It turned deadly when a counter-protester was killed. After the rally, Rundo and three of his RAM buddies were arrested. This made Rundo think. He wanted to create an organization that was less vulnerable to infiltration and arrests by authorities. And that's how active clubs were born. Rundo was eventually arrested again in March 2023. He was in Bucharest, at a gym. He's currently facing rioting charges. As Brody mentioned, through a leaderless resistance model, he created and encouraged a network of localized, less detectable groups. Without one clear leader and hierarchical command, it is much easier to avoid the collapse of the whole movement.
They are one of the most international or transnational leaderships that I've seen within a far-right group. So you have figures like Christopher Nipak, who's the founder of Active Clubs Canada, and of course Robert Rundo, the founder of the U.S. Main organization, who have gone and traveled abroad, whether that's in Sweden or Romania or Finland or even Ukraine. They've gone abroad and really networked and learned and shared skills and experience with other far-right extremists right around the globe. And I think in this way, the movement really reminds me of what we've seen over the past 20 or 30 years with the Salafi jihadist movement, where you had figures like Abdullah Azzam or Abu Musab al-Sarqawi going around the world and really building these networks, building these skills and experience, you know, trainings that they could then bring back home. And it's part of the broader story of how far-right extremism has gone transnational in the last 10 years. But I think that if we look at the impact that these veteran jihadists had on the global jihadist movement and extrapolate that to the far-right, it's a really dangerous threat, because these figures who go abroad and get this training and get this experience, they often come back much more effective and much better organizers. And I think we're starting to see the impact of this sharing of information and skills and networks already impacting the development of the far right, both within the US, but also Europe.
And how has the internet facilitated this globalization or transnationalization of the movement?
So the internet and a number of key platforms in particular is key to this growth. While they're decentralized and therefore protected from law enforcement action or crackdowns, they need some way to communicate with each other and to build a coherent movement across the US or across Europe. And the way that they've really done that is through platforms like Telegram and, to a lesser extent, Odyssey and Rumble. But Telegram has been the main home base for active clubs and the various cells that make up the movement. And on those platforms, they share everything from encouragement with one another to training videos on how to, you know, conduct what they would call operations without encountering law enforcement or without getting, you know, into legal challenges. And so the movement really organizes itself online. But because their focus is so much on real world engagement and not just being keyboard warriors, they have bridged this gap in a way that allows them to use the internet to grow the movement, but not just stay stuck in an online echo chamber.
You mentioned, obviously, they are displaying training and that kind of thing, but what is the messaging behind it?
Yeah, it's really quite interesting within the far right space. You see that active clubs propaganda differs from a lot of other groups out there. So they focus, yes, on training and tactics, and that is quite, you know, important for them to share skills across this decentralized network. But they also have a very big focus on health and fitness and exercise, things that are, you know, much more, let's say, friendly or more positive than a lot of far-right groups out there. For instance, they'll organize hikes and camping trips for their members. They'll go and pick up litter or trash in their community and then publicize photos of their group doing that, not even to outside audiences, but just to their core audience as a way to show that they are engaging and not just being stuck behind the computer. They have a very clear view that the far right should get out from behind their computers, you know, avoid being keyboard warriors and actually engage with the real world. And I think that, you know, whatever aspect of the propaganda you look at, this message of positive, proactive, healthy fitness, engagement with the real world, all of these elements come out in almost every piece of propaganda that they publish.
Right. Okay. And so who are they aiming this propaganda at? Who are they trying to attract?
Active Clubs views itself as the vanguard of the movement and really an organization that can bring in new people that would not normally be attracted to typical neo-Nazi groups. Given, you know, the really massive geographic range of this group, that there is no one typical profile beyond a few core characteristics. You know, so these are by and large white men, although not exclusively. You know, we see some strange anomalies with Latino or other groups getting involved, but by and large, you know, the vast majority is white men and some women, although the women participating is still quite a new part of the group. And then the other thing that I think is really, really important to focus on is these are men who don't have a lot of options, right? They may be underemployed or unemployed, usually with limited post-secondary education. These are people who don't have a lot of options, and this provides them, you know, a really unique sense of community. The last part that I think probably makes them unique is these are people who are predisposed to gym culture and to MMA and to sports already. You know, this may actually differ from some of the audience of the far right, you know, who maybe is like history buffs or, you know, people who are a bit more bookish. These are certainly guys who have been active and played sports and engaged with the real world, you know, probably even before getting involved in an active club.
You've touched on this a bit already, but what makes these groups so appealing?
I think they appeal to a number of different things. The first is this sense of community or fraternity, which is very strong within any organization like this. It gives what would otherwise be isolated individuals a place to come together and to train with one another, to work out with one another, and even in some cases to hold each other accountable. You see a lot of focus on this. They're big on making sure that their members actually are consistent and training and always ready, in their view, for active operations should they arise. And being part of something bigger than yourself is, of course, very compelling to anyone. But when it comes through a shared activity, I think it's even more powerful. And that shared activity of working out together, training together, you know, engaging in MMA competitions together really gives a lot of the young people involved in it a much better sense of their identity and their personal strength and their personal confidence. You know, as they're building their physical strength, they're also, I think, developing, you know, a lot more confidence in themselves and a lot more hope and positivity about their own futures, which is dangerous when it's tied to an extremist organization.
Is this an aspect of the movement that makes them especially dangerous?
I think so. What I've seen within these groups is as these young people are joining and training and, you know, in many cases becoming stronger, healthier individuals themselves, they feel a real sense of loyalty and connection to the active club that they have joined. And this is because they're actually seeing some positive benefits in their own life, and perhaps giving them a sense of agency that they were lacking beforehand. Remember that most of the people who are attracted to a movement like this have few other options. And so this can be actually quite a powerful motivator. You know, most extremist groups, they simply take from their members, whether that's time or resources or, you know, putting their legal safety in risk. But active clubs are somewhat unique in offering some limited benefits back to their members in the form of helping them to get fit, helping them to get healthy, helping them to have a strong community of people doing these things. And so I think as the members, you know, receive some limited benefits from their association with this group, it really cements a stronger sense of loyalty and community than we see in other far-right groups out there.
And is there a social dimension to recruitment for these organizations? So is it likely to be social networks like friends and families that are getting recruited?
Yes, I think that there's both a social and an online dynamic to recruitment. The first is oftentimes this is something that will be shared amongst friends in a gym or in an MMA training space. You know, it will be, you trust, you know, somebody who you've known for many years, and they'll talk to each other and share a little bit about the movement. But then when these individuals go online, they'll have more exposure to the group, and they'll start to see what it's about. And they really try to get people into the organization by starting out in kind of gentle or softer forms of extremism and allowing them to become part of the movement before they're fully indoctrinated. One former member of the group told a media organization recently how they sort of gradually and incrementally indoctrinate members. And they start out with this focus on fitness and training and health before they introduce the more heavy doctrinal ideological parts of the movement. If they want, they reach out usually through dedicated Telegram channels that are intended to vet the different users. And there's a number of sort of complicated ways that they do this, both based on ideology and social connections. But it really is this combination between online and offline methods that the group has used to not just expand, but also make sure that they're not admitting people into the organization who they consider to be a risk to it.
And how would you describe women's role in the movement?
So women don't play as large a role in the movement by far. However, in the last few months, I have seen active clubs try to highlight some of their female members and actually get them more involved in training and activism. And I think that this is quite unique within the far right as well. They are putting forward a vision where women can help play a role in shaping the future and the operations of the organization or of the various cells within the organization. And so I think, you know, we'll see this continue to grow where they have a more active and participatory role for women. They're still, you know, absolutely very misogynistic and tied to the sort of neo-Nazi white supremacist ideology that pervades the entire movement. But I think that their active participation of at least some women, however in small numbers at this stage, is unique within the far-right space.
And has this translated into violence linked with active clubs transnationally?
We do see some violence both in the US and Europe associated with active clubs and active club members. There's two categories of this. The first would be what we traditionally think of as indiscriminate violence or terrorist acts. And there is some concern there. For instance, a number of their members, particularly in Canada, have been joint members of the Atomwaffen division, which do use firearms and have been designated as a listed terrorist group. And I should say on this point, there's also a number of both current and former military members within active club groups, both in the US, Canada, and Europe, which adds to the fear that, you know, a genuine terrorist attack could come from this group. But to me, the more unique and more interesting part of these groups is actually the potential for them to interfere with the democratic process and with elections.
We've already seen examples of violence by members of active clubs in the US. As we mentioned before, Robert Rundo was arrested at the Unite the Right rally in 2017. But it's been even more overt than that. In October 2023, a pro-MAGA mayoral candidate, Gabrielle Hansen, was on her way to speaking at a debate in Tennessee. But as she made her way through the parking lot, she was flanked by members of the local active club. They claimed they provided security for Hansen after some alleged threats against her. The local police hadn't heard of any threats of that kind. Instead, the active club members threatened citizens and journalists during and after the event. And the scene elicited historical parallels. The Brown Shirts, the original paramilitary wing of the Nazi Party, were famous for their violent intimidation of Germany's leftists and Jewish population during elections.
2024, we'll see elections not just in the US, but actually in 50% of democratic countries around the world, which will be holding, you know, a major election. And I think this is something where we see they can have a real political impact on how, you know, our elections are shaped, or how, you know, voters think about attending a political event or even just showing up to the polls. If there's a genuine threat of an extremist group either harassing you or actually in some cases causing, you know, serious harm, that's going to make people more resistant to engage in the political process. And I think that that is potentially the biggest threat that we see from these groups over the next, you know, 12 months. Now, I just want to also point out, not all active clubs expressly support Trump or his party. In fact, there's significant disagreement within the active club group. Some of them, you know, view Trump as too establishment. Some of them, you know, view him as a sort of false messiah. But others seem to have come, you know, to the recognition that he still represents their best hope. And so I think their political views are very malleable and ever-changing. And so, you know, as we look forward over the summer and even into the autumn, when the U.S. political system really heats up and some of these indictments and some of these legal challenges start to play themselves out, I think we should be very prepared and very concerned about the risk that active clubs or active club members may play in trying to interfere or disturb the democratic process around that.
Yeah, it's interesting what you said there about active clubs, members having different political beliefs. Is there a strand of the movement who are completely anti-democratic and more trying to disrupt elections altogether?
Absolutely. I think, in fact, that it's a significant portion of the organization that, you know, subscribes to some form of belief that democratic processes will never result in the change that they want to see. I mean, at the end of the day, these are a genuinely, you know, revolutionary organization. And I think that for a lot of their members, there is no peaceful democratic solution to the change that they want to implement. And so they're, you know, in many cases, but both in their propaganda, but also in their online actions, they're very willing to use violence and very willing to involve, you know, extra democratic methods in bringing that about. However, they're also cautious and they want to avoid prosecution and you know, undue attention from law enforcement. So you'll see them sort of hedge and carry out actions when they can do so safely. But at some point, you can also see a scenario where this tips into, you know, outright mass engagement with the political system to try to subvert it or to interfere with it.
And what can be done to counter this movement, both online and offline?
It's a very difficult challenge to solve, obviously. But I think that there's a few things we can say about it. I mean, the first is that extremism is always a byproduct of societal change and disruption. And so any response needs to come from a very holistic place. It needs to be not just one action here, one action there. It has to be something that really, you know, changes the system. However, in a practical way, I think there's a few things we can do. The first is that this is a moment when we need to speak to these platforms that have not taken action before and really show them what this could turn into, show them previous examples of what it has turned into, and call on them to remove their platforms from being essentially an organizing home base for a lot of these groups. And the second broader, you know, societal point that I think is important is really going after the economic uncertainty that a lot of their members are facing. At the end of the day, you know, a lot of this does come from economic concerns that their members have, and providing them with better options to engage with their community in sort of safer ways to form community and form positive, healthy identities that are not rooted in this far right, neo-Nazi extremist ideology.
Yeah, I think it's a very difficult challenge, especially the online dimension and countering groups and content which aren't necessarily violent, but obviously have, you know, dangerous ideas. I think that's very difficult to counter. In relation to alternative options for these young men, is it about giving them something active, but again, isn't obviously not violent? It's just different forms of sports and activities that they can do.
Absolutely. I think that one of the big things governments and public sector agencies need to do is really provide these potential recruits with healthier, more positive forms of engagement with their community. So that could be sports programs, that could be acting programs, that could be entrepreneurial programs to get, you know, young people involved in things that give them a sense of identity, a sense of purpose, and a sense of community. But they do it in a way that is healthy and not rooted around, you know, a very hateful sort of backwards ideology. That's, of course, a very big challenge for policymakers. But we have seen steps towards this in many other contexts. And I think it's something that absolutely over time we can move towards.
You can find a link to Brody's research in the show notes. If you want to hear more about far-right extremism in the US, we just released an episode on that as well. That link will also be in the show notes. And if you want to learn more about Tech Against Terrorism and our work, visit techagainstterrorism.org or follow us on X at @TechVSTerrorism. I'm Archie MacFarlane. This is the Tech Against Terrorism podcast. Thanks for listening. Please rate, leave a review, and share the episode, as that really helps new people find us. This is an OG Podcast production, produced by Anouk Mie. Music by Rowan Bishop.